Hello and welcome to the podcast of Lotus Eaters. This is episode 472. I'm your host, Harry, joined today by Josh.
Hello there.
And today we're going to be talking about the sad death of British pubs, or at least certainly seems that way.
It's really bad, yeah.
Yeah, it's not looking good for everybody. Libs of TikTok poking the hornet's nest yet again and getting suspended off Twitter again. And also one third of Pakistan being underwater. Without any further ado, let's get into it.
The Pakistan underwater thing. That isn't the first segment, by the way, but it's like the song "Been to the Year 2000," is it, or 3000? They live underwater.
Never mind. I wasn't expecting a busted reference. Jesus Christ.
Just gonna throw off the rhythm.
Just gonna throw that at me first thing. What on earth?
I'm sorry, but anyway, the lockdown mania that swept over the world, and Boris Johnson's suicidal green agenda has meant that the cost of living has basically skyrocketed in Britain. This is a particularly deadly combination for our pubs, who cannot cover the cost of shutting down over the pandemic, as well as going along with the absurd hikes in energy cost, which are, you know, unaffordable for everyone, but because a pub has very high energy usage.
It's not just that, it's the fact that for households in Britain, there's the energy price cap, which means that there's only a limit to how much they can charge you. Obviously, that cap's going up this month, but that's one thing, whereas businesses don't have an energy price cap at all. So I was talking yesterday about how energy prices are going to be going from like £13,000 for pubs to £35,000 in some cases.
That's only a small amount compared to some of them.
Oh, so really?
Here we have Reuters, last orders, UK pubs brace for mass closures as energy costs soar. So if we move on to the article by The Standard, pubs are preparing to swallow energy bill hikes of up to 400%. And of course, remember that throughout the pandemic, the pub owners were having to live off of their savings more or less, or borrow money just to get by because their main source of income had been closed because we closed all the pubs.
I, at the time, was living in a place where you had to go through a beer garden to get to it. So I was right next to the pub, and those guys who owned the place were really struggling.
Yeah, so the fact that the cost of running a pub now is going to be astronomical is going to gut Britain of its pubs. So there's an article here from the Daily Mail which cites some specific figures. We risk losing the British pub forever. Venues choose between closing down or charging £14 a pint, which is extortionate. I mean, maybe in London you could tolerate that price, but anywhere else, normally the price of a pint is about £4.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's like they're saying,
if you're lucky.
You can either choose between you close down or charge £14 a pint, which just means closing down but slower, because people, like you said, that's extortionate. People aren't going to put up with that. People aren't going to go to the pub.
You could get a really nice bottle of red wine for that, let alone some beers.
Well, who knows for how long, but
that's true. But yes, it carries on to say that some may now shut down for 2 days a week and cut menu items amid an £80,000 spike in energy bills. I mean, it's a wonder that they're worried about cash, because this is the horrible consequences of a terrible green agenda that is making us dependent on energy that can't provide. I mean, we have things like fracking and the North Sea oil that we could be capitalising on, but I'll get onto that later. But there are so many things that we could have done to avoid this. Here's an article, another one from The Standard. Will the last pub in Britain to close please turn out the lights? And they're basically looking at this pub exodus and saying that, well, in, say, 100 years' time, will there even be any pubs left? So apparently, George Orwell's favourite pub is among those under severe threat. I'm sure loads of communists are delighted at that. Apparently, the British Beer and Pub Association, the trade body even, whose members own half of the UK's 47,000 pubs, say thousands of pubs will close rapidly unless the government does something to ease their energy bills. Apparently, the sector employs nearly a million people, and between 2019 and 2020, pub numbers fell by 13,600, or 22%. So we've already lost a sizable portion already. And apparently, there was another fall of 15% in 2021. So this is devastating already, and it's going to get a lot worse.
Yeah, this has been something that's been going on for longer than just 2019 through 2020 until now as well. It's been going on for ages. You've seen for years news reports of however so many pubs closing down, you know, 15%, 20%, 30% of pubs closing down over a particular period of time. And it is a real shame because anybody who lives in England knows that we like our pubs.
We certainly do. And I'm going to be talking about the cultural significance of them
in
great deal once I've given a few examples. So one of the examples is from the Bournemouth Echo here is a Dorset pub, which coincidentally is the county that Bournemouth is in, closes after £58,000 increase in utility costs. So how can a business run when it has costs like that? It's absurd. And the fact that we are gutting the heart of our communities here is just unforgivable. I mean, all the people that called for lockdown, this is the consequence. You're basically going to be living in the pod, eating the bugs because you ruined your country. And we're seeing it. I mean,
you are right when you use that term, heart of the community, because the pub, and this is one of the reasons that I think this sort of stuff is intentional right now, which is the pub is the place where you can all meet up on the weekend or on a weekday with a bunch of friends who you maybe don't get to see very often outside of going to the pub with them. And you can just talk. You can switch off from politics. You can switch off from your job and you can be a normal person. Whereas
it's also a place that is almost exclusively patronised by the native Britons as well.
Yes, I noticed that as well. You don't get that many foreigners in pubs most of the time.
And more often than not, if they are an immigrant, they're normally kind of Britishised and integrated, aren't they? They have the same values as us and kind of culturally indistinguishable. So it's like a benchmark of how British you are is how much you value the pub. The more British, the more you like a pint. As far as I like to see it.
Yeah.
That's how I like to console myself when I'm hungover, at least.
I'm just identifying with my culture.
So, yes, here we have another article from the BBC covering this pub in York. Pub closes as monthly energy bill almost trebles. If we have a look at a picture of it, if you scroll down, John, nice sort of town centre pub there. Nice traditional sort of view, the hanging baskets, It's got the sign outside. It's got all the hallmarks of British culture, yes. And it is gone, unfortunately. There's also some iconic pubs here as well. Here is this next one is the Tipperary on Fleet Street, which is a self-declared oldest Irish pub in London. And as you can see, it looks pretty old. You can tell. Mm. I think this was the pandemic that wiped this one out.
Oh.
So it wasn't the rising cost of energy. But yes, there are lots of iconic ones, and even the large pub companies are closing down. So here Sky News is reporting that BrewDog to close 6 pubs due to spiralling cost and no prospect of help from clueless government. I mean, it's nice to hear my IPA of choice insulting the government, even though they are a little bit woke, unfortunately. But
yeah,
they make good beer, so.
Well, something else.
Do you like local stuff as well?
Yeah, something else to point out here. I don't know if you stop me if you're going to get this to the cultural impact as well, which is that where I'm from, there has been a few venues closed down. Not necessarily the pubs, but some of the really terrible, sleazy clubs have closed down. But most of the time, those buildings that they're occupying don't end up getting used
for
anything anytime soon.
They stay vacant for a very long time because normally the areas in which these places are, they try and optimize for high footfall and normally more for the nighttime economy. So,
So they end up just sort of hanging around as this empty shell, like a corpse just lingering.
It is like we're hanging the corpses of our culture out to display to everyone that we're a dying country. It's so depressing to put that way.
We're not being overwrought about the pubs, okay? Ask anybody who's English. Pubs are vital to the culture that we have here.
If we can't get our pints, there will be riots in the streets.
I welcome it.
I mean, I'm saying that a bit tongue-in-cheek, but actually, yes, it kind of is true.
Yeah, no, there
will. Imagine all the North FC types.
Yeah, North FC will rise up against the government.
It'll be like a horde of, a plague of locusts will descend on the South, all wearing their football shirts.
Yep.
Drinking our
Parliament
pints.
Will be taken, Downing Street assaulted.
Well, this is just making it sound good.
Yeah, I was going to say, nothing of value lost.
But to carry on reading from this article, James Watt, the founder and chief executive of the company, said in a LinkedIn post that the hospitality sector faces sheer rabbit-in-the-headlight paralysis of this zombie government as rocketing costs threaten the future of many pubs, restaurants and bars. He said it was heartbreaking to lose 6 pubs, but added, reality in the hospitality space is starting to bite and bite hard, and the government needs to get a grip now. And I quote directly here, "If nothing happens, the UK looks set to lose half of its pubs and bars and all the millions of jobs these locations provide, as well as the vital role they play in the local communities." And this is kind of resonating on a very important point. And I wanted to emphasize why this isn't just me whinging about losing my favorite haunts. It's that they have a really important role in British society and British culture. So obviously, the most self-evident thing is that there is going to be a large social impact. The pub is the beating heart of any British community, really. It's where we meet our friends and socialise with our neighbours, people we wouldn't otherwise talk to, but we feel like we're in a community because you go to the local pub, you've got all the people that live around you, and you start to make connections with the people who live near you, at least if you live in a relatively nice area.
Yeah, but you're a pint or two down, you're a bit looser than usual, you're probably more likely to go to talk to somebody that you've not interacted with before, mm-hmm. especially if they're in the same situation. Mm-hmm.
But where I grew up, there's a really strong local community, and you could go into a local pub and see people you recognised, and it really felt like you were a part of something bigger than yourself. And the fact that it's a place where you build bonds with other people and become closer to them, well, it's just going to further isolate people, make them atomized individuals with no connections to the outside world and therefore easier to control. I mean, I couldn't possibly name all of the memorable situations I've had in pubs and the meaningful things that have happened. Debates have been won and lost. Loves have been loved and lost in the British pub. Almost going to turn into poetry here.
Drinks spilled.
Oh, plenty
glasses
of that,
glasses smashed.
Although, I've never done that, to be fair.
Have you never smashed a glass? Impressive.
Only when working behind the bar.
Yeah, I think I've only done it working behind the bar as well. But no matter what pub you're in all across the country, if you smash the glass, you'll get the signature.
Whee!
No matter where you are. And that's how you know that this is a country worth fighting
for. Thing is, it's never malicious. So whenever I smashed a glass and people went, whee, I was just like, I'd take a bow.
Yeah.
Really lean into it because it's funny that people reacted that way because it's infantile and needless. But yes, but it's such a shame that a place where I, many millions of other British people have spent treasured time with one another are going to be disappearing forever. Of course, there's also the fact that one thing I love about the British pub is that even in a small village, they'll have a nice pub, won't they? And I'm sure you've been to many before. And I've got lots
First
of good anecdotes.
Choice,
of,
really.
I've got lots of good anecdotes of going camping on Dartmoor for a couple of days and then coming across this rural village tucked away in a valley, untouched by the outside world. And then you go in there for a nice meal and a pint before going back out into the wilderness. And it's like the most wholesome thing after you've been doing some hard graft, yeah. You go out.
The owners
into the world.
As well, the owners of these places tend to be like figureheads of the community almost.
Well, yes, and for many people, the pub is the centre of their community. And particularly in these more rural areas, these are the only places where they can really gather, isn't it? That if their one pub in their village closes down, well, they're all going to cram into someone's house and do it informally.
Yeah, if you're a little village and you start taking all of your meetings in like random mm-hmm. fields and places, people are going to start asking questions.
But yeah, many pubs rely on just a select group of loyal patrons and they don't really get people from outside. So they can't really adapt to change quite as easily as you might otherwise imagine. And it means that a lot of these rural pubs that are the heart of communities are going to close. And it really is kind of devastating. And when I was preparing this segment yesterday, I was kind of seething in the corner, just like, this is really bringing it home, how much we've ruined this country, that one of the last bastions where British people can go and actually enjoy other people's company in their own culture, in a familiar place, and it is getting destroyed. And of course, I haven't touched on the fact that they're all very historic a lot of the time. Many of our pubs are many hundreds of years old. Many of them are older than the country of the United States. We still have pubs open today that are frequented by historic figures. So there are pubs in London and Stratford-upon-Avon that are frequented by Shakespeare and people like Dickens. And you can go to a place where Tolkien would have gone. All of these figures, you can go to the pub and more or less the same.
I was in Oxford a month or two ago and, you know, I went on a little ghost walk and they tell you about Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and the pubs that they used to go to, you'd stop around at places and be like, oh, this is where Tolkien and Lewis used to meet up and discuss ideas for the stories that they were writing. It really does give you a much more full picture of mm-hmm. the area that you're in.
Well, yeah, you're steeped in history, and it elevates the experiences you're having because you're in this lovely historic place. And you can't replace that once you lose a pub and it gets degraded, it's been closed down for a long time. Even if someone comes along and buys it, it's not going to be the same. It's not going to have the same atmosphere.
No. It's especially nice, I find, when they've got actual wood-burning fires.
Yeah.
Nothing quite like sitting down with a bunch of mates by a fire with a few pints.
That is one way they might be able to avoid the energy costs, is having, I mean, the price of logs isn't going to go up too much, yeah. I imagine.
Could do wood fire, start lighting candles around the place, mm-hmm. really bring back the old school aesthetic.
Well, all of my favourite pubs do that, to be fair. There are a lot of pubs that I go to back home in Plymouth where it's basically lit by candlelight. And it's lovely. It's got a much nicer atmosphere than these... I'm going to sound like Superhands from Peep Show, but like these city boy pubs with, where it's all clinical and it's all just modernist nonsense. You don't want that, really. You want something nice and historic and to be steeped in history when you're enjoying people's company.
Yeah, you want the layout and the actual structure of the building to be just a little bit mm-hmm. asymmetrical as well.
So here we have National Geographic looking at 7 of England's best historic pubs. And I'm not going to look at the actual article itself, but just have a look at the picture that they've included, John. So here, look at that pub. It's lovely, isn't it?
That's brilliant.
They've got the nice wood fire. They've got the traditional pub chairs that I'm pretty sure everyone's seen in at least a few pubs before in Britain. Sort of dark wood pews that you sit on. It's exactly what you imagine when you imagine.
Just looking at that makes me feel a bit warm and cozy inside.
Exactly. And that is what the government has taken away from us. This is so infuriating. I'm trying to stay relatively calm about this.
You've no idea how angry he is about this. No,
I am angry.
In a very sincere way. And rightfully so. Rightfully so.
So yes, it's worth mentioning as well that this is what British culture looks like. And if you want to learn a bit more about that, on the website we have a premium video, I believe it is with Beau and John Wheatley, titled What Are British Aesthetics? And this talks about what British aesthetics are like. And if you want to know a bit more about that, certainly check it out. So it's also worth mentioning that this isn't the only attack on traditional British culture. Of course, the traditional pub food of fish and chips has been criticised, as we covered, I believe, last week on the podcast here.
Yep, they'll be coming after bangers and mash next. you smile, but they will.
It may well happen, to be fair. Although I'm not a fan of bangers and mash. Unless you've got to drown it in gravy for it to be palatable.
Well, yeah, you get the gravy as well. But, I mean, like, actual nice gravy that's made from, like, the fat of the meat mm-hmm. that you're making as well. They're coming after that. They're coming after everything.
Instant gravy is haram.
I can manage it, but I prefer actual
You probably
gravy.
Drink it by the gallon, being a northerner.
Yeah. I mean,
that's a tired old stereotype, I'm sorry. But yes, I thought I wouldn't be entirely depressing and end on a slight white pill, is that Jeremy Clarkson is buying a pub despite the gloomy forecast. So there's at least going to be one pub open because it's going to be bankrolled.
He's got the money to sustain it. Yeah, that's Jeremy Clarkson is actually becoming at this point kind of a stalwart Brit as far as I'm concerned.
He's become a farmer, a pub owner.
Yeah, he's gonna be that guy at the local village. Well, actually, no, he already is that guy at the local village because he causes a lot of trouble down there. But no, it's good that somebody with the kind of financial resources mm-hmm. that Clarkson has behind him is trying to do things to keep the country England.
Mm-hmm. And there's something from up your way as well here in this next article. Cheshire Pub job advertisement pleads that snowflakes don't apply. And if you scroll down on this one, John... There should be a picture of the board somewhere.
It's quite a lovely
bit further
looking
down.
Pub as
it
well.
It is a nice looking pub, yeah. There we go. Please ask inside for details. No snowflakes, please.
Good.
So there
That's
are
what we want to see. That's
based the pubs out there
North
as well.
FC right there. I looked into this because I was like, oh my goodness, Cheshire Pub, is this somewhere that I've been to before? It's not. And I don't know how accurate it is to say Cheshire because it's kind of near the Wirral area approaching Liverpool.
It's all lost on me.
Yeah, well,
I'm far too southern to understand
this.
These
is
references.
Just the cultural differences showing here.
But yes, I wanted to close out by saying exactly why it's the fault of politicians, though I have already alluded to some aspects of it. And I think it's in part due to that annoying autistic Swedish child with fetal alcohol syndrome, Greta Thunberg, for anyone who didn't get it, scorning our domestic fossil fuels. She pressured lots of governments. And obviously, it's not just her.
It shows the weakness and how pathetic our political establishment
is. Manipulated by school children, yes. But no, it's probably mostly other people, to be honest. And yeah, we've more or less hampered our ability to be energy self-sufficient. And it proves that economic literacy amongst the population needs to be good to have a thriving society, because all of this green stuff, everyone was saying this is going to be expensive, this isn't going to work, we're not going to have enough energy. And we went through with it anyway. And lo and behold, here
we
it
were
is.
Right.
Yes.
As always.
Mm-hmm. So we should have capitalized on resources like the ones talked about by Liz Truss, although I don't believe she's actually going to do it, talking about fracking and the North Sea oil drilling. I mean, we should have been doing this yesterday, not now or in the future. We should have been using this to be self-sufficient and not have to import energy from places like France. I mean,
who've recently...
on the French as an Englishman is abhorrent to me.
It is. Also, the French have also screwed themselves over recently by shutting down more, well, closing more than half of the nuclear power plants that they had in operation. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, who could have predicted this? Their electricity bills are skyrocketing. Who would have seen that one coming, eh?
I never would have guessed. And of course, the lockdowns and all the people that called for them, you're killing the British pub. And I can't forgive you for this. You are murdering British culture. And you shouldn't let people off for this. If you supported lockdowns, you should feel ashamed for yourself.
I'm impressed that you managed to maintain some composure right there, because you're genuinely furious about this.
I should be,
and everyone watching should also be very furious about this. All right, then.
I'm so furious, I'm going to have a pint of water now.
The wrong kind of pint, but still, you know, as long as you've got glass in your hand, you feel a little bit more secure.
Mm.
All right, then. So, Libs of TikTok has poked the hornet's nest again and been temporarily suspended off of Twitter for, I think, is the third time at this point. Simultaneously, she has also received a ban on Facebook, all for things that, whenever you get a ban or temporary suspension from these sorts of things, they say, broke community guidelines, don't specify any further, and in all likelihood, it's because of mass reporting and flagging by the same usual suspect, journos. Yet again, the people who some people for some reason trust to get honest information from.
Yeah, well, lots of left-wing journalists have been unduly targeting her, I think. She's become a bit of a scapegoat for the
right. She really has. Oh, we'll absolutely see some of the scapegoating going on,
trust me. And because Taylor Lorenz, the insufferable journalist who doxed her, published her personal information and went after her family despite hiding behind an anonymous account,
showing up at her family's home, etc. There were photos of this at the time. This was a few months ago, back in, what, April, was it, really? And she came at her expressly with the intent to destroy her.
Well, it's intimidation, isn't it? If you turn up to someone's home, you're basically signalling that you know where they live and that they aren't safe.
And who knows what you could do with that information? I mean, she's the journalist for a massive publication like the Washington Post. There are very obvious yet implicit threats that come along with that, and it gives them also plausible deniability. If you say you're threatening me with this, they can say no, I'm not, I'm just trying to do my journalistic job, you know.
Yeah, most threats in the modern day aren't as explicit as in The Godfather. It's more subtle than that. They rely on a sort of grey area where you can deny it, the plausible deniability.
Now, we need to bring back more...
careful what you're saying, Harry.
I'll stop there. But before I go any further into it, we've got this recent article, seeing as it's relevant to the subject, where lots of people have been asking what is a woman? Matt Walsh most famously asked that in his self-named documentary earlier this year, What is a Woman, produced with the Daily Wire. So our very own Daisy Offer, in her very first article for
us, our social media manager.
Yes, we're very proud of her for coming out with an article. No, legit, I'm quite
yeah,
happy
of course.
That she came.
I've read it and it's very good.
I've not read it yet, but I've read the first few paragraphs and it seems to be that she just does not want to even engage with this thing anymore.
Well, it is ridiculous. Like the whole debate around it. I mean, we all know what it is, and even the people that say they don't know what a woman is knew what a woman was at one point. Just be like, harken back to when you weren't as insane.
Harken back to 5 years ago before you cracked your head on the fall. In that fall, you know, like, but yeah, she wrote that article called What a Woman Isn't, which should be very interesting for everybody because there's multiple dimensions to the question of what a woman is that I think, as much as I really enjoyed Matt Walsh's documentary, just throwing out the adult human female, that's not going to cut it. That's not going
to
cut it.
There's a lot more airs and graces to a woman than just your biology.
Yes. But let's carry on, shall we? So Libs of TikTok, as I said, got locked out of her Twitter account again. Babylon CEO Seth Dillon shared a screenshot of the hateful conduct message of Libs of TikTok's account claimed to have received. Hi, Libs of TikTok. Your account has been locked for violating the Twitter rules. You may not promote, and here it comes, violence against, threaten, or harass other people on the basis of race, ethnicity, national origin, sexual orientation, blah-de-blah-de-blah, all the same sort of laundry list of reasons that don't get applied towards one side of the aisle, but always get applied towards the other side of the aisle without getting any more specific about why it is. Which one of these it is? Was she violent against people? Did she threaten people? Did she harass people? Is being a journalist just harassing people? Because I could say that Taylor the Wrens has harassed somebody and that her behaviour that caused me to say that exists outside of journalistic integrity, whereas Libs of TikTok just seems like an old school journalist, if anything else. She's interested in the truth and wants to get the word out to the people about the truth.
All she does, I say all she does a lot, but she finds stuff that has already been published online and draws attention to it. It's not like she's doing the on-the-ground journalism. People are already creating the stories, but she's drawing attention to what she thinks is important. And she's grown in popularity because people agree that the things that she has drawn attention to are important. And that's why the profile has grown to such a large level.
So much of it nowadays consists of this gender ideology that's being pushed on kids. So obviously people are going to think that's important because it might be their kids that get hooked on this stuff. But as an example of some of the stuff that she's done recently, she was talking about Boston's Children's Hospital providing hysterectomies and mastectomies to teenagers under the age of 18. And journos were predictably mad about this. Hoes mad, as you would expect. But she has consistently recently got emails directly from journalists asking for comments on these sorts of things. And I think she has a good tactic here, which is where this person's like, oh, what types of surgeries that they're doing at the hospitals are you objecting to? What do you hope to achieve by drawing awareness to the transgender healthcare being provided? Mutilation being provided at Boston Children's Hospital. If you just click on this image for me, John, just so we can see Libs of TikTok's response to this. I notice you've got pronouns in your bio and the made-up word Latin X, so unfortunately I can't take you seriously. Best of luck with your story, which I'm sure will be completely not biased and totally based on fact. Kind regards, Libs of TikTok. Probably the best way to treat these journalists, which is you are not a serious human being. You are not somebody who is interested in talking truth. You don't care about the facts as much as you may defer to them when it's convenient for your side of the narrative. So no, I'm not going to engage with these people. The only reason that Libs of TikTok engages with these people in the first place is to reveal how awful they are.
Journalists stopped trying to actually look at the truth, and they're just cheerleaders for political candidates. And although, of course, we have our preferences, we are at least upfront when the evidence seems to go against our beliefs.
Yeah, bias is unavoidable.
Well, of course, you're a human being. You can't be unbiased. It's impossible.
Exactly. But the best thing that you can do, like you say, is be upfront about your biases so people can maybe adjust how they're perceiving you to go along with those biases, you know? But the most recent thing that this all seems to have stemmed from, the thing that really got her in trouble, along with Boston Children's Hospital, is that she spoke to the Children's National Hospital of America recently and questioned them on whether they were performing gender-affirming hysterectomies. For those who aren't aware, a hysterectomy is when you remove part of the uterus to prevent a woman from being able to have children, on 16-year-old girls, and possibly even younger. And to make sure that she got the evidence of this and nobody could question it, she recorded the phone call. Let's just take a little listen to that phone call.
I've contacted quite a few hospitals already. It seems like it's difficult to find one that does the operation for my 16-year-old And I was told that you guys do that. So if you do it for 16-year-olds, then yes, I'd love to schedule an appointment, a consultation, whatever you need.
If you don't mind me asking, what is your child's gender change into, so I can point you to the right direction?
Yeah, well, he transitioned to male. You know, he already had the top surgery, and now we're looking for the hysterectomy.
Okay, beautiful. So I'm going to transfer you to the GYN nurse line. One of the nurses will give you a call to give you more information and to let you know the steps and the protocol that they do for that, okay?
Okay. So they would do it for that age?
Yes.
And there you go. That was speaking to the one of the workers, I think, in the actual clinic where they perform those surgeries, because there's a bit of fluff to the beginning of the call where she was just getting through to the right people, and then they just confirm it.
Mm-hmm. To take back what I said earlier, that's obviously some great journalism going on there. Actually,
yeah,
recording the call and confirming that these places are doing it, because at the minute people are being gaslighted. Obviously, they know, we know that they know. However, if
they
we
still
have,
lie.
Yes. So if we have the definitive proof, they get caught out.
And this, of course, led to some controversy with the hospital, because people were not happy to hear that a hospital was performing these kinds of surgeries on minors. People,
rightly so, though.
Yeah, rightfully so. I don't think this surgery should even be performed on people 18. I think you really need to wait till probably at least 25 to make sure that the brain is developed enough to truly understand the consequences of your decisions.
There are schizophrenics that believe they're Jesus. Do you think that they should nail themselves to a cross and put a crown of thorns on their head? No.
No, they like to hold a double standards, though, because they know that one application of this logic is advantageous to them, where all others aren't. It's the same that happened in the What Is a Woman documentary when he was speaking to the trans doctor, and he went, oh, there are people who, you know, believe they shouldn't have an arm and want their arm cut off. Do you think that that's at all comparable to what you're doing to kids? And the person, she's just like, no. No. She just refused it because they can't accept it, because if they were to accept it, their entire narrative would fall apart. So they push it anyway. But after that happened, the usual suspects came to the rescue with NPR, first off, releasing this article. Children's hospitals are the latest target of anti-LGBTQ harassment. Rightfully so. Rightfully so. If this is what they're doing, if they are mutilating children, they should be targeted and they should be shamed and petitioned and lobbied into not doing that anymore.
If mutilating children makes you in favour of LGBTQ, then I'm happily anti-LGBTQ.
Yeah. And this article, I mean, I'm definitely anti-LGBTQ as a political movement. That's that's just altogether, you know, gay people and lesbians, whatever.
Your sexual preferences aren't a matter of my politics. I don't care.
Yes, but when you turn your sexual preferences into politics that get directed at me and directed at people's children, that's when you might find some pushback. But the article goes on, as you would expect, where they're talking about hospitals and doctors facing harassment and even death threats over the medical care they offer to transgender kids. I'm having to put all of this in quotation marks because it seems they forgot to when they were writing this.
There's lots of loaded language in here. We could have done with this article when we did the contemplations talking about journalistic tricks.
We could have, couldn't we? And you should watch out for that contemplations, because it'll be a good one. But they've been subject to posts by a Twitter account called Libs of TikTok, as well as stories in conservative media, which raises the question, where should social networks draw the lines with accounts promoting narratives that spark harassment campaigns on their platforms and beyond? So NPR is asking obviously the important questions here, the questions that people are really asking, not how are these hospitals letting this happen? No, where is the line at which it's acceptable to ban Libs of TikTok altogether? That's what they're asking here.
Never mind the fact that Libs of TikTok was definitely harassed by Taylor Lorenz as
and
well.
And doxxed.
Yeah, well,
Taylor Lorenz released her name. I mean, it seems that Libs of TikTok, Chaya, as her name is, has leaned into it because she included her real name in the clip that we saw.
She doesn't really have a choice.
Yeah, she doesn't have a choice. But that's not, yeah, like you say, that's not something that she chose to do. That's something she was forced into doing, which is pretty disgusting. The Children's Hospital in Washington, D.C. became the most recent target this week when they posted the audio recording. The hospital has said that this claim was incorrect and that none of the people recorded deliver that care to patients.
But they were the receptionists.
They were the receptionists.
Of course they're not going to deliver the care.
But presumably they know what goes on in that clinic. So unless you're saying that this hospital, unless the hospital is saying that they're horribly incompetent and nobody in there knows what's going on at any times, I'm sensing some discrepancies here.
They're obviously lying to cover their own behinds, aren't they?
Of course they are. And they carry on. The information in the recording is not accurate. We do not have and have never performed gender-affirming surgeries, hysterectomies, for anyone under the age of 18. Notice the narrowness of that, though. It might be actually true that they've never done it. It might be an option for those under 18 once they've matched some criteria, but just because you're not performing the hysterectomies, potentially, doesn't mean that you're not open to the opportunity to, or that you're not doing other, not quite as bad, but pretty bad stuff to these children. For instance, they carry on, they just say the operator speaking provided the wrong information. And these false narratives about pediatric gender-affirming care are rooted in fundamental misperceptions, said Dr. Angela Cade Gupford, a pediatrician and director of the Gender Health Program, so she's not at all ideologically biased in any way, at Children's Minnesota. People have misperceptions that we're doing surgery on young kids. I mean, I've seen photos. We know that at least some of the hospitals out there are doing it on girls as young as 12 and 13 years old, which is beyond the pale. At that point, you're in prison.
Why do we always cover this on the podcast? It's so depressing.
Well, because it's relevant,
I know, sadly. We have to cover it, but it's just...
If this is
it's like the worst thing that people can do.
If this is somebody's first Lotus Eaters video on YouTube and they're not aware of all of this stuff, it's worth bringing up every time, sadly.
Well, no, it is important. I mean, more from a... I am suffering having to listen.
From your morale, yeah. But people have misperceptions that we are changing kids from boys into girls at a very young age. And they said that care for transgender kids is wide-ranging from efforts to help children socially transition, because that couldn't have any negative repercussions, to puberty-blocking medications.
But we know that they do so much harm. How can they call themselves clinical health professionals when we know that, for example, it can cause brain problems and development problems, skeletal problems, muscle-forming problems, all sorts of things where your development is completely impeded by taking these puberty-blocking drugs.
Yeah, well, it's because of the fact that they can just get away with it. That's sadly what is part of the agenda. They're more than happy to push it because they're absorbed in the ideology and they can get away with it. So that's how they do get away with it. And as well as NPR, Washington Post came to the rescue with this article. If we go along, they came up with this. John, thank you. Where they were talking about, here's the article, and then the actual author of the article as well, a Pete Jamison. And of course, they're really focusing on the... if you go to the next one, thank you. They're really focusing on our right-wing threats, where these hospitals are being threatened. And they go on in the article itself, in the next link. They go over a lot of the same information that NPR covers with the same sorts of excuses, but they once again reinforce this idea that, it's not going on at all. It's not going on at all, which is where we're at the it's not happening stage of denial. Whereas in a month or two, it will be, it is going on, yes, that's true, but it's a good thing. And anybody going against us is a fascist. I mean, they're already on the anyone against us is a fascist train, but they'll be able to just openly admit it. Mm-hmm.
It's also worth mentioning, don't send threats to hospitals.
No,
go through legal means, make it illegal in your state if you're in America. Do the best you can to get these places closed down, but by threatening the hospitals, you're giving the opposition ammunition to then present opposition to these hospitals as some sort of radical thing that violent extremists do. Don't give them the ammunition. And of course, I'm talking as if these things are done in good faith, which they're not. But
no,
still,
of course not. But in response, and they mention in this article that they tried to get in touch with Libs of TikTok directly, and they said in response to a request for comment for this story, Rychik immediately agreed to an interview on the condition that she'd be allowed to record it, but after learning the Post had missed that response and published the story before an interview could be arranged, she stopped communicating with the Post, understandably, and expressed outrage on Twitter. That's not how it works, she tweeted. And at the bottom of this article, we can even see they left a little clarification, which shows the honesty and prudent journalism than you can expect from the Washington Post, where they say an earlier version of the story incorrectly indicated that Rajcik had not responded to a request for comment. The Post was not aware she'd responded through Twitter message before the story was published. And Libs of TikTok talks about this, saying that she responded within 12 minutes. So in that 12 minutes, the person just couldn't respond to their DMs. They just must have been away from the phone.
I'm but surprised they're somewhere. Conducting stuff over Twitter DMs rather than
I know.
Email. It seems...
But,
strange.
You know, despite being away from anywhere they could check their Twitter DMs, they were able to find something to publish this article on. So that's something, I suppose. But it goes to show the dishonesty of this, whereas, the, you know, they didn't want to get a response. They just wanted to get in touch so that they could say.
They want to be able to say that they got in touch to give the appearance of being fair in their journalistic practices. But in actuality, they really don't want someone to give them a comment.
No, because they don't want to present both sides. But elsewhere in the article, they point out here, hysterectomy can be formed in addition to mastectomy for people transitioning, but the procedure is almost never offered to children. Like the qualifier
almost
there,
never,
almost.
Though.
Almost never. Experts said, because we've got to trust the experts, and the current standards of care published by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, why there needs to be one of those, state that the surgery should not be performed on minors. So the whether or not the institutions say this officially doesn't say what they're actually doing. You can say anything officially. It's not in any of the paperwork anywhere, yeah, but there can be informal verbal agreements to do this sort of stuff anyway.
Just don't take people at their word.
No, of course not. Yet children's national officials admit that some of the information put out of the hospital has increased public confusion. Before Thursday, and this has changed now, the hospital's website erroneously stated that gender-affirming hysterectomy was available to patients between the ages of 0 to 21.
Ugh.
0 to 21.
Zero.
Yes. An error that has been corrected. And in Rajcik's...
Error, was it?
Yep. And in Rajcik's recording, two hospital employees answering the phone state unambiguously that a minor patient could receive a gender-affirming hysterectomy. So even when they're trying to deny it, they have to admit it. Because they know, well, you've got the recording, you can hear it for yourself. Everything that we're saying is obvious BS. So we're going to have to deny it, but also acknowledge it at the same time. Okay, that's just an admission right there. Everything else in this article is completely useless, except for that one paragraph where they say, yes, they said that it can happen.
I mean, if you're going to do evil things, at least have the decency to own up to them. Don't lie about it and then hide. Because
they're having their head cake and eating it as well by denying it and admitting it. two paragraphs separately from
it's
one another.
It's ridiculous, isn't it?
It is ridiculous. And on the basis of the mentioning of not threatening hospital workers and such, I will have to mention this as well, because the Boston hospital that she originally exposed a few weeks ago did have some major threats, including a bomb threat, which it doesn't matter how awful the stuff that's going on in this hospital is, and as much as we object to it, don't do these kinds of threats, and certainly don't do these kinds of bomb threats, because the hospital might have to evacuate. Whether or not there's some bad stuff going on with trans healthcare, there are probably a lot of kids in this hospital who do need medical attention that's for serious conditions. This can interrupt it and could put people's lives in danger.
I'm pretty sure I've been to that hospital before, actually, in Boston.
Oh, really? I've never even been to America, so I'll make sure to avoid. But then... Libs of TikTok herself also pointed out that Pete Jamison, like he said, the author of that article, had been in touch. This is where she revealed everything regarding the fact that it had only been 12 minutes between her responding and everything else. But if we just scroll down this little thread here, she noticed a little bit of something about this article, just down to the bottom of her thread, if you wouldn't mind, John. Here we go. Wouldn't you know, on the article itself, Taylor Lorenz contributed to this report. What a surprise. Taylor Lorenz obviously has a massive hate boner for Libs of TikTok.
That term.
It's a great term. It's a great term. You've got to admit it. Taylor Lorenz despises Libs of TikTok, is trying to ruin her life, and seems to want to get involved in literally anything that could be detrimental to her career, and I would not be surprised if if Taylor Lorenz personally is behind this latest temporary suspension. At the very least, we know that these sorts of journalists are going to be getting in touch with Twitter and reporting her, or just actively emailing their contacts within Twitter saying this account needs to be taken down for this reason, etc., etc. Because this is the last post she managed to get off before she got suspended again. Before reading any of the regime propaganda you'll see about this story, make sure you listen to the entire recording and read my report. They can gaslight and lie, but the evidence cannot be more clear. And on that, she got suspended, which is a shame, but I'm honestly shocked at this point that it's only ever temporary suspensions. They don't seem to be able to pin her down on doing anything wrong because, well, she doesn't do anything wrong, but it's still only a matter of time before she gets banned altogether. So we'll see what goes on. Don't listen to any of the regime propaganda, and please keep your kids safe.
So, a third of Pakistan is underwater, obviously because there's been some flooding. And so far, I think 1,350 people have been killed. Nearly a million livestock animals have been killed. A million houses have been washed away. 40 plus reservoirs have been breached. 220 plus bridges have collapsed. 90% of their crops have been damaged. There's been a 10 billion loss to their economy, and 50 million people have been displaced because it's a country of with a population of 230 million people.
Right. That sounds awful, and I'm sad to hear that for the people of Pakistan. But, and I don't want to sound insensitive here, this does sound like something that should be worrying to us as well.
Yes.
50 million people displaced, where are they going to be going?
Well, we've already got a sizable Pakistani community in Britain, and they have, we have imported such greatest hits as grooming gangs. One third of all child birth defects are Pakistani because of their tendency to marry their cousins. So they're not exactly the most useful of immigrants in our country, to put it as nicely as I possibly
not
can.
Not doctors and firemen. Like,
well,
we were
I'm
sold.
Sure there they may
I'm,
be.
I'm sure there's some. A few, but certainly not in the sorts of numbers that we were
but
sold
if
on.
If you get immigrants from a country that isn't part of the first world, you import values that aren't from the first world. I mean, that's not surprising, but of course, there are set up communities there where they can just be around Pakistani people, and therefore they don't need to integrate. They can stay the same.
If any other communities tried to do anything similar, they would, of course, get shut down immediately.
Say but, the native British one.
But perhaps we should move back onto the subject, because
of course,
as much as we complain about this sort of stuff, it is still terrible.
Oh, yes, of course. It's a massive humanitarian crisis and a tragedy, and lots of innocent people, no doubt, losing either their homes or their lives. And I feel very sorry for them. And I think that people should be doing stuff to help. So according to the BBC, one third of Pakistan has been completely submerged by historic flooding. Its climate minister said that's going to be a feature that we're going to talk about later on. Apparently, they've washed away roads, homes, crops, and it's all across Pakistan. To quote here, "It's all one big ocean. There's no dry land to pump the water out," Sherry Riemann said, calling it a crisis of unimaginable proportions, at least. 1,136 people have died. I think this is slightly old numbers now. Since the monsoon season began in June, according to officials, because of course they have their monsoon season in what would be our summer. The summer rain is the heaviest recorded in a decade and is blamed by the government on climate change. But notice that they said in a decade. That's not really that long, is it? So how can you attribute it to climate change? It's a bit silly to me. So I'm quoting here, "Literally one third of Pakistan is underwater right now." You can tell that this woman is American, "which has exceeded every boundary, every norm we've seen in the past. We've never seen anything like this." Officials estimate that more than 33 million Pakistanis, one in seven people, have been affected by the historic flooding. So if anyone doesn't know where Pakistan is, for a start, here it is on
our American viewers, for instance.
I didn't want to say it. I've made that joke before on the podcast, and people had a go at me. To be fair,
well, bring on the booze.
Our American viewers are much brighter than the average American, I imagine.
That's true. All of our viewers are much brighter than average than anybody else out there.
And we're not being made to say that. I genuinely believe it as well, even if I do have a grin on my face. So yeah, there's Pakistan on the world map. It's next to Afghanistan, believe it or not, and between India, which is part of the reason why they have such historic rivalries. So let's have a look at the size of Pakistan to emphasize just how big it is relative to, say, Europe. So if you move on to the next link, John, here we have an image of Pakistan overlaid over continental Europe, and you could see that it would take up, what, France, Germany, Belgium and the Netherlands, yeah, with that little bit poking out.
I mean, it stretches from northern Spain all the way up to northern Poland and southern Denmark.
It might be the equivalent of the entirety of France being underwater, which, when I put it like that, sounds awfully appealing, doesn't it? I'm only joking. On a completely unrelated note to endless floods that ruin large tracts of a country, here is an article on lotuseaters.com about immigration is the reason you can't get a house. And this is, I believe, Connor and Callum talking about the housing crisis in Britain and how it was caused by immigration.
And witless Tories just constantly go on because they don't want to address the immigration issue, because they don't want the Guardian to call them a bunch of racists. They instead focus on how we've still got this amazing thing called the Green Belt, and there's all these amazing countryside vistas, all these wonderful woodlands, and we should just be tearing them down and building houses on them instead. That's their answer.
So I wanted to show a fair amount of footage about what's going on. So here we have a compilation of some various clips I found online, which John has thankfully edited together, just showing the extent of the flooding. And it basically goes out from this point as far as you can see. And obviously it's a third of the country, but then a statistic like that is very difficult to get your head around. If you're listening, by the way, all we're looking at is just this massive flat plain where the odd tree is poking out of the water. And here we're seeing pathways of people wading through water to get to safety.
You can see where the roads were, but they are completely submerged. People having to go out onto boats and what I was assuming.
Push cars and ride motorbikes through it. And here we have a train. This train is the Shalimar Express, travelling through the Sindh region of Pakistan, which is one of the four provinces. It's actually the southeastern province here. So yes, I've basically scoured online to find stuff. Yes, it's a train. It looks like it's from Spirited Away.
Yeah, it does.
Just the train driving through the water. But yes, it looks like something from some sort of dystopia. What's that 90s film with a really high budget? Was it?
You're going to have to narrow it down.
The one where the entire world is covered
water
in water.
World?
Yes, that's it.
I mean, it's kind of a simple name to remember for the subject, isn't it? Kevin Costner's famous flop.
Yes, it's very much like that. So we can have a look at some before and afters here. If you can scroll down, John, and move the sliders on some of the images. I think it's there at the top of the images. There we go. So it's massive. And if you go for a few of those, and there's the before, and there's the after. The riverways banks have basically burst. Here's another one, which is even more severe. Yes. Like the difference between that is massive, isn't it? And there's another one by CNN, which has more or less got the same thing, but that's pretty severe. And here you can see there's a river valley, and then here it is afterwards. I mean, it's looking a lot greener, but also there's a lot more water there. And here's a picture of people basically setting up on the edge of roads because they can no longer live in their houses. And obviously lots of innocent people are being harmed by this.
Yeah, imagine how awful that would be. That you just wake up one day, your entire living room is completely flooded, all of your possessions are probably ruined and destroyed, and you've got your job, you don't have one anymore, you've got nowhere to go.
Yeah, it's a truly horrible thing, and I think that it's one of those things where we should be putting our political differences aside and helping people. And although we already give foreign aid to Pakistan, people, grassroots, donating stuff is certainly good, because certainly lots of innocent children here that don't deserve it, even if you don't approve of, say, their politics or their religion. They don't choose to be born into that society,
no,
do they?
No, of course not. If it, people going over there directly and, you know, doing what these people seem to be doing in some of these pictures and actively just being on the ground helping out, anything can help in these situations.
So let's have another look at some more footage, shall we? This next one goes through some floodwaters in the streets, which basically looks like a horrific river, doesn't it?
Looks like rapids.
Mm.
I assume it's just bouncing up against something in the middle of the road there.
And this is actually one of the less bad ones, because there's some worse footage here where we'll see in a second of it collapsing entire buildings.
Christ.
Here we go. Here's
is
one.
Is that somebody on the roof? Oh, no, it's just some
fixture. Aerial, I think.
Yeah, but yeah. The pixely video.
It's sinking like the Titanic, isn't it? It's just a massive building being swallowed up.
Well, there goes someone's home or business.
Well, it's a large building as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
So the fact that it's swallowing up just massive tracts of the country, they're basically going to have to rebuild from scratch. Here we can see loads of rocks being carried by the stream. So anyone who gets caught in this is almost certainly dead.
Well, that's the interesting thing as well, is that this is all dirty water by the looks of it. It's full of mud. So if you get caught in it, or if you touch it and you've got maybe a cut or an injury on you or something, that's almost certainly going to be infected. And what are you going to do in Pakistan?
Yeah, well, that's, we're going to cover that in a second, how the presence of lots of water brings about lots of waterborne diseases. So this looks horrifying. And here's just the inside of a town. This is a flooded town in southern Punjab, which is obviously another region of Pakistan. And you can see that everything is flooded. You can't really get away from it because it's so flat. But don't worry, I will be looking at some nice, positive, uplifting stuff. People doing good things in a second. But no, it's really terrible. Here it's going through the centre of a town again. It looks like there's loads of mud that's been piled up as well. So obviously when the water retreats, because the water is so muddy,
the
lots of their towns
are
going to be buried. Yeah. So I think that's the end of the video there. So after I've shown some horrible stuff, let's look at people being nice. I've found a compilation of two videos, someone saving a cat, and if you're not a cat person, someone saving a dog. So here's a guy, he's got the cat on his shoulder,
aww,
going across a raging torrent. It almost...
The cat's freaked out, understandably so.
I'd be pretty freaked out as well. So yes, don't say we just give you black pills. Here are people being nice.
This is both nice and adorable.
Mm-hmm. And here is someone rescuing a dog from a hole. And
that's good. It's good to see that people are able to... Because obviously when you see these sorts of things happening, you worry that it's just going to break out into anarchy, every man for himself style thing. But this is people showing their humanity and their sympathy, not just for each other, but also for their animals and their pets. Because
this guy's getting a face full of dirt to rescue this dog.
Yeah, because sometimes you expect that, oh, when it's every man for himself, we throw aside the other virtues that we have, one of them being the kindness we have to our beloved household pets. Certainly happened in China, for instance, when they had lots of issues, say, during the Cultural Revolution. So it's nice to see something happen where the cats and dogs aren't immediately be thrown under the bus.
Also, here we have on Twitter... someone reporting that a hotel is staying open for free to allow people to use all of their services. So I imagine they provide food and electricity, showers, stuff like that, for people who have been affected by the disaster and have lost their homes. So people are opening their doors. It's also, here's a BBC article talking about how... the Disasters and Emergency Committee in Britain, which is made up of 15 charities, has launched an appeal to try and help people in Pakistan. And there are also lots of cases of people individually setting up their own fundraisers to help people out as well. And I believe I was able to find out that Turkey and the United Arab Emirates are also sending planes full of supplies, although I didn't have enough time to find out all of the countries that were donating. But I'm sure there are lots.
Though.
Yeah. So people are helping out. But of course, as you alluded to earlier, as the Independent reports, Waterborne diseases are spreading among many of the flood victims in Pakistan. Apparently, Pakistani health officials on Thursday reported an outbreak of waterborne diseases in the areas hit by recent record-breaking flooding. Diarrhea, skin diseases, and eye infections are spreading at relief camps set up by the government across the country. Over 90,000 diarrhea cases were reported from one of the worst-hit provinces, Sindh, in the past 24 hours, according to a report released by health officials. Also, of course,
people need to remember, because people think of diarrhea and they just think, oh,
inconvenient,
gross, yeah, and inconvenient. But no, you can die from it because it can dehydrate your body to the point, because it's mostly liquid.
But also remember that loads of their water reservoirs were broken, loads of dirty water everywhere. They don't really have access to clean water, which you don't really think of in a flood, do you? But it wipes out the infrastructure for that, because a lot of the pipes are obviously in the ground as well. So quite often they get dug up and disturbed when the water's that strong. But another thing that's happening is that there is going to be a massive hunger crisis in Pakistan, a country of 230 million people. So yes, obviously the crops and livestock have been washed away, when the cost of crops and livestock is probably at a global peak at the minute. So apparently, farmers in Pakistan's Sindh, the country's second largest province, estimated that 80% of onion, tomato and chili crops, along with 70% of rice crops that were about to be harvested, had been destroyed. So this has all the makings of a national tragedy, and very few people are actually talking about it with the seriousness that it warrants.
Yeah, absolutely, and because this sort of, all of these effects that we're seeing right now are just going to lead, sadly, to probably more deaths down the
absolutely
line.
Yeah, it's going to be horrific as a humanitarian crisis, both for the people of Pakistan and for all the people that are going
on
relying on the resources, and all the people that are going to be taking in this massive influx of refugees, and actual refugees this time,
yes,
for once. So let's have a look at some of the reactions. Of course, India, being next door, had some floods as well, so let's have a look at the video of the Indians dealing with their very meager flooding in comparison. Here we have a platform with a red carpet on it, which I just thought was amusing, because I'm not sure if they're taking an opportunity just to dunk on Pakistan, because they're not
exactly... It wouldn't be the first time, would it?
They're not the best fans of one another, are they?
No.
India being a majority Hindu country and Pakistan being a majority Muslim country.
Sorry, just the red carpet's making me just think, is this just how they do things in Bollywood?
To be fair, when I went to Venice, they had platforms like that, but there wasn't even a red carpet. I couldn't believe it.
Oh, no, they didn't even roll one out just for you?
I know, I should have told them in advance, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
It was a horrible day for it as well. It's like scalding hot. But anyway, moving on. There have been, of course, some ridiculous takes from leftists.
Oh, no.
This is the obligatory section.
Oh, no.
Flooding has devastated Pakistan, and Britain's imperial legacy has made it worse. Yes, it's imperialism that's made this
bad. The colonial legacy had just been floating in the ether, waiting for its time to strike.
Pakistan gained its independence from the British Empire in 1947, yet the reverberation of imperialism have endured. As a consequence, peripheral regions such as South Punjab, Balochistan and rural Sindh are resource-starved, exploited and poverty-stricken, factors that have grossly exacerbated the flood's disastrous effects. I don't think it was the British Empire that was, you know, the one that made Pakistan poorly set up.
Poor infrastructure.
I think it was poor when we arrived and it was poor when we left. And there's only so much we could do. I mean, we built the first railway in Asia, in India,
and
when
we
were there. So who knows how many millions of people that saved being
they
able to
run
agricultural
stuff. They have had 75 years between then and now to improve things.
How guilty do we have to be? I mean, we did run things quite well.
We have to be perpetually guilty, Josh. You know this.
But yes, it's going on and on about how there's some sort of large inequality in Pakistan,
how their rulers, people need to flog themselves over it.
How their rulers have these nice palaces and some people live in mud huts. And, of course, it's worth pointing out that things like the Taj Mahal, I'm pretty sure, were built before the colonial era. So these massive differences in wealth existed long before. I mean, obviously that's in India, by the way. But, you know, it was all part of one country when we ruled it, the British Raj, wasn't it? So They only broke up when we left, which is also why there's border tensions and why people don't get along anymore. So that's not mentioned, is it? The potential of war. But
no, anything that would take away from Britain's culpability for this is just ignored.
So, of course, The Independent, never one to miss an opportunity, said, Pakistan floods, is climate change responsible? How can you know? No, probably not.
So it's China's fault then?
And as we are running out of time, it says, while many scientists would argue it's too soon to say for certain that the climate crisis is to blame for Pakistan's ordeal this summer, not without completing the necessary intricate calculations, comparing and estimating facts with theoretical modelling of a world without global heating, the signs are all there.
So before we've done any work, I'm just going to say it anyway.
Yes.
Listen, guys, I've not seen the Earth from a distance myself, but I swear it's flat. I just need to wait for the empirical evidence to come to me first.
Ah, you're a flat earther.
Oh, you know it.
So, of course, not one to miss out on being a moron, Jeremy Corbyn weighed in. The future is already present and it's distributed unevenly. Climate breakdown is causing historic floods in Pakistan and droughts in China and Europe. We need immediate support for the Pakistani people, decarbonise and funding for the front line.
I thought Jeremy Corbyn was outside of the mainstream paradigm. I thought he wasn't a filthy globalist. Whoops. Whoops, I suppose. And also, if it's causing all these problems for China, you'd think that the Chinese solution would be to obviously cut their carbon, seeing as they're the number one global contributor.
Pretty sure they release more carbon than all of Europe combined and North America. There is that. And the final thing I wanted to end on is just how out of touch British Pakistanis are with what's actually going on. Here's, I think he's Pakistani. He's at least some form of minority because he's got the brown emojis. That's how you know.
I mean, you would hope that these sorts of people would be the most sympathetic.
Just a reminder to all, it's Pakistan, not Pakistan. Please, kind of takes away from the four-letter racist slur that the racists call us, and it's how Pakistanis pronounce it. Thank you. So you've just got to say Pakistan. You can't say, that's apparently not racist. But if you
apparently
do it,
putting on the accent isn't racist.
But if you just say Pakistan, if you say it with the accent which I have, then I'm being racist. Do you really think that's true? No. But that's not the focus here. That's just a bit of stupidity. Obviously, we want everyone in Pakistan to recover safely. It may not be the case, but I don't think that innocent people deserve to suffer in a natural disaster, and hopefully things get on the right track soon.
All right, let's move on to the video comments.
Good afternoon, fellas. I keep hearing you guys talk about how packed your country is. I don't think you fully realize just how bad it is. England is the size of my state, Arkansas. England has a population of 56 million people. Arkansas has a population of 3 million. If the United States were to have the same population density as England, we would have 3.5 billion people.
Still my beating heart, the idea that the geographical space of England would only have 3 million people in it. I think that's less people than in London alone.
I mean, this is like my fantasy, isn't it?
It really is.
Not because I want people to die, but
we don't want people to have
more space.
We don't want people dead. We just want them to move out. Okay, I just want them, you know, get back on your rubber dinghy and go back to France, please.
But yes, obviously some really good and interesting facts there.
On the subject of ruining franchises, I remember one of you guys bringing up that you hated the Alien 3 movie, and well, I was disappointed as a kid, too, about it. In hindsight, it was actually a fairly decent story with good acting and kind of good production. It's just that it completely derailed the story that we had been set on, that everyone wanted more. I suppose I might enjoy it now since I'm older, and I appreciate the workplace vibe the whole movie gave off. Can you guys think of any other movie that was decent but completely destroyed a franchise at the same time?
Star Wars.
No, those ones aren't decent. If anything, I would say actually the prequels carry on the spirit of the originals, but are just so executed so terribly.
I think the alien free conversation was between me and you in the Politics of Fight Club video, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, because we were talking about David Fincher. I've not watched it. The most I know about Alien 3 and what I is the mainstream perception of it, and also the opening plot points of they get to the prison ship or prison planet, whatever it is, and the little girl and the kind of love interest as well from Aliens just immediately die. Off screen, you see their frozen corpses, and then they're just gone altogether, which kind of destroys the plot line that had been built up throughout that.
I mean, I enjoyed the film, but it wasn't as good as the previous two. I mean, my favourite is actually Aliens, when they go in with all the guns. I'm just like, yeah!
Yeah, the James Cameron one. I there's a special place in my heart for the first one. Ridley Scott's classic is
more
a classic
of a,
for a reason.
More of a horror film.
Yeah, but I remember I was like, oh, you know, Alien is the best one. Obviously, the first one's the best one. And then I watched them back to back, and I was like, actually, Aliens is pretty awesome.
They're coming in through the goddamn walls, man. Game over, man. That alone makes the film.
Can you think of any films that were good but ruined the franchise anyway? I'm struggling to think of... I know
it's
there
a difficult
are some.
Question, yeah.
There definitely are some. I just can't think of anything. I would imagine... I can think of a game that is amazing on its own, but people argue ruined the franchise around it. Would you like to hear that? Resident Evil 4.
Really? Like,
well, it's a wonderful game, and I don't even necessarily agree with it. I just know that there's a certain consensus around Resident Evil 4, 5, and 6, at the very least, because 7 and 8 changed tactic again. Whereas Resident Evil 4 changed the formula completely and kind of changed third-person shooting games forever, because then it led on to Gears of War and such. And then that's a fantastic game in its own right, but then people don't like 5 as much and didn't and really hated 6 when that came out and said the franchise was dead. So that's the only example that I can think of. They managed to revive it with Resident Evil 7, but there's my contribution there. That's the only thing I can think of.
Hot damn, you think about all these people on Twitter and you'd think that they're a bunch of racists for hating people from Idaho. I don't understand this. How can these people be such a hateful bunch of assholes that they can't understand people who don't live in cities like they do? It's like they come from a completely different world or something. I have no idea, you know. I bet they would never be able to live in a town like where I live. They couldn't stand it.
Good. Keep it that way. Don't let them stand it if they move to a town like yours, because they will ruin it. That was in reference to our Sydney Sweeney segment from yesterday that Nick did, that definitely wasn't just an excuse for Nick to look at images of an attractive young woman.
Were you trying to torture that poor man? You know what he's like.
Yeah, no, he's very neurotic. So just pointing out that that's what he was doing was hilarious. But no, I think the whole thing of like, oh, we're not hateful, but we are incredibly hateful towards the people who are our enemies, is it's always been like that. And the whole peace and love, we need to have open discussion, etc. Maybe the sort of 1960s leftist hippie attitude that people had was just a veneer. It was a mirage. It was a skin suit to make people live up to their own principles, whereas these people never cared about the principles in the first place. They just cared about subjugating you.
I think the going has to be really good for you to have that sort of hippie mindset, but things aren't good, and therefore you can't be peace and love and that stuff. You've got to get down dirty in the politics of it.
No, I mean, you and I are both libertarians. Mm-hmm. I mean, at the extreme end of things, ideally, I would be like full-on Ancapistan type. But at the end of the day, I need to acknowledge we live in the real world. Things aren't that simple. Political power is being wielded against us. And just saying, like, I just want to be left alone. Well, the people wielding political power aren't going to leave me alone and don't want to leave me alone. Mm-hmm. So you've got to do something about it, right?
Which is why Americans have the Second Amendment. Unfortunately, we don't.
Yes, we let that get taken away from us. Anyway, let's move on to what looks like a clip from Lost Highway.
So a friend of mine who's actually a college professor offered an interesting insight on demisexuality. And that's that it's just a defense mechanism for normal women at college. Because feminists have basically inverted the standard to where women are supposed to act like stereotypical frat bros and have as much casual sex as possible. And demisexual is a way for normal women to exist within the feminist paradigm because, yeah, my sexuality is I don't f*** randos. I'm not a whore.
Yeah, that's
that sounds about right.
That's
me,
absolutely
yeah.
true. Yeah, I was like, demisexual. I've heard that. I've forgotten what it was. And it's literally, I only get sexual attraction to someone I get emotionally attracted to first. So it's like, oh, yeah, being normal.
Yeah, I was going to say.
I'm pretty sure for hundreds of years, this was the norm for people to do.
Tens of thousands of years, surely.
Yeah, almost certainly. But no, it is a shame that people, to excuse their normal behavior, have to come up with these labels for it. I'm sure there are some of these women who don't understand that they're just normal people from 30 years ago. But yeah, it is a shame that they need to attach the labels to it. Anyway, let's go on to the written comments. So the first one we've got here is kind of unrelated to anything we've spoken about today. Tim Tigriff, apologies for the off-topic question. Joe Biden recently did a speech about how fascist the Republicans are while looking like a Saturday morning cartoon villain, may I add. We've not covered that today, mainly because I think Carl...
He bagsied it, didn't he?
Yeah, Carl bagsied it for Monday and Carl's not in today. I find this laughable, as you should, but perhaps I have a blind spot. Can you do a steel man of their position so I can better understand, please? I worry that they think that everything contends with their power is fascism, it's fashionable to call opponents fascist. It's too easy a reason when I fail to see flaws which may later become apparent. Thank you. The most I can really do to steel man it, because for the most part I do think that fascism as a term and a concept is so completely removed from the context and meaning that it originally had in the early 20th century, coming from Italy, that it is mainly just used as a buzzword to beat people over the head with, because people do have this connotation with it as being, oh, it just means that you're an evil person who wants to stop people from doing harmless things that they would be wanting to do anyway. But the best steel man that I can give for people who might actually believe what they're saying when they call people fascist is that from the 1940s, late 40s to the 50s, in Los Angeles, because of course it had to start there, Theodore Adorno, one of the Frankfurt School theorists, and a few of the others, I forget exactly who, but Adorno was the main one behind it, released a book called The Authoritarian Personality, where he basically associated any conservative-leaning personality traits with authoritarianism. People kind of have this idea of authoritarianism as being bad. For the most part, I would agree with them. But they're associating any sort of upkeep of standards, whether they be personal or the standards that you uphold other people to, as being authoritarian is one thing and kind of creates that association in people's mind. Then he also introduced the F scale test into schools in Los Angeles in the 1950s, which was developed to determine how fascist you are, whereas really what it meant was how conservative you are, because the Frankfurt School theorists thought that these conservative ideas that people like Mussolini and Hitler might have had about the way that you should uphold your behavior is what led to things like the Holocaust and extermination of different peoples, etc., etc. So people who have been raised in that paradigm, that's why it seems to all emanate from Los Angeles for the most part, and why Los Angeles is a real hive of this stuff, though you might just be carrying on that thought process with people being indoctrinated for a very long time.
Obviously, we know it's not true, though, because many of the conservatives and new people at home that we come into contact with
Are lovely.
Prefer smaller government. We want less government, not more government.
Of course we do.
So it's the opposite direction of
Well, I think we kind of have an inherent recognition that virtue is something that can only be cultivated through freedom of choice.
Yes, you've got to be able to make the decisions for yourself. Otherwise, if you're doing the right thing but you've been coerced to do it, then it's not as moral a choice, is it?
No, of course, it's not a moral choice at all at that point. It's an ultimatum that's been put down upon you.
Absolutely. So read some comments about the death of the British pub. Nick Croft, every Friday and Sunday evening for decades, my dad got up from his armchair around 8:30 p.m., put on his jacket and walked to the local Red Lion for a couple of pints. He never rang a friend or arranged to meet anyone. He just turned up knowing that more or less the same crowd would be there. And even if they weren't, he was equally happy striking up a conversation with whoever happened to be sitting next to him. There's something wonderfully wholesome about that.
Oh, absolutely.
It certainly is, and I've done that many times myself. And
it is really nice. Yeah, you can just go into a pub. I've done it so many times, even when I'm just like in a bad mood and I don't want to be there or something. And maybe I'll have a pint, there'll be someone next to me who wants to strike up conversation with me, and then all of a sudden you're in a lovely mood, you're having a great conversation with somebody that you weren't expecting to be, you weren't expected to meet, and it just really just picks you up, really, doesn't it?
I really enjoy talking to new people as well, and it's one of the areas of British life where it's acceptable. Normally talking to people randomly other than, you know, your average chit chat, particularly in a city, is frowned upon. And I grew up on the outskirts of a city, but it's nice to be able to have meaningful conversations about interesting things with people you've never met before. And it's a very valuable skill. And to be able to actually talk to people who you have presumably nothing in common with and actually have interesting conversations and get along with them, I think is very important. And we have this perception in the Western world that we seek out people who are kind of mirror images of our own personality. And sure, you do get along with them better, but it's still important to meet people who are different. And I think that actually you'd be surprised at how well you can get along with someone who you would think you had nothing in common with. So, Bleach Demon, as a Yank, I am utterly horrified by the threat of closure of the English pub. My experience in visiting pubs were the highlight of my travels and wildly entertaining. I cannot imagine Britain without that institution. It would be America without firearms.
I mean, it's true.
Yeah.
It's very true. Actually, there's another point as well. I've met many interesting, I know we mentioned, you know, the foreigners who live here, who integrate and become basically Britishized and then go to the pub regularly as a result of that. But I've also met lots of very nice foreigners who've been maybe just visiting on holiday for a week.
I think it's like a selection pressure of if they want to actually truly experience an aspect of your culture, they'll go to the pub and experience what it's like. So you meet people who are open-minded and that sort of thing. Because when I've gone abroad to bars and stuff, when they realize I'm foreign, they kind of, their face lights up and they want to talk to you because you're like, oh, you're experiencing my culture. You care about what I'm doing. That's really nice. And it's like a flattering thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Jordan Turner, with the pubs dies England.
Sadly, yes.
Yes. Baron von Warhawk, hopefully once pubs start closing down, people will sober up and start thinking about what these politicians are doing to their country. Well, that's a very optimistic way of looking at it. Yeah. I hope so. Or they're going to end up drinking at home, which is probably more likely.
Yeah. I've worked at a bargain booze before, man. Some people will just show up every single day and pick up like a 16 can of beer just for themselves to go home and drink to. And I just think, how are you still alive?
Yeah. The reason I stopped bartending is like a part-time job when I was at university was because it was just so depressing seeing the same people again and again. And there were nice characters, like there was an old guy who'd come in for just a pint or two. I'd always make an effort to have a chat with him because I'd be the only person he'd talk to that day. And it's nice to actually give back to the community.
When I was working at the pub, there was a local guy who came in who's quite short, and every time he came in he would order the same drink, so we just, because he was short and it matched the drink, we all just called him the half pint. He was fine with it.
It's not too negative, is it?
Or at least he acted like he was fine with it.
Free Will 20112, it's not a shame, it's a crime engineered by Machiavellians who pose as our representatives when they are actually representatives of a sinister global cabal. Well, yes. I'm saying it's a shame that it has to happen, but yes, I'm very angry at the people who did it in the first place. Alpha of the Betas, Harry's pub tour. This is the pub Dickens puked in front of. This is the hedge Tolkien peed on as he staggered home.
Yes.
I would like to go on that tour.
I would absolutely like to go on that tour, because isn't it interesting, though, that it puts these historical figures who are so completely abstract in our minds now in such a human light?
It does, yeah.
It really does. And that's a good thing as far as I'm concerned.
I'm going to read one more before we move on to your comments.
Yeah, of course.
Jussi Soppenen, talking face-to-face, for example, in pubs is it's easier to discuss difficult topics with friends because of non-verbal communications. Unlike online during lockdowns, when there is only resonance inside echo chambers and burnt bridges outside of them, pubs make divide and conquer and such control more difficult, so that it must go. I actually thought that exact thing.
I was thinking the exact same thing when you were talking about it. Yeah, because you can prevent a unified front. You come together as a community. You come together, not to sound like a commie or anything. You come together as a collective when you're in a pub. It's easy. Yeah, when you've got a group of good lads who are a few beers down, right? You can get them.
We built an entire empire that covered 25% of the world's mass after a couple of blokes had a few pints and was just like, you know what, why don't we go off to Burma? That's a good idea.
Exactly, exactly. You can change the world starting in a pub. Libs of TikTok, I'll go on to this. So Christian Anderson says, Josh, you seem to know a lot about hormone blockers and puberty blockers. Would you mind writing a well-sourced article about what they are, what the difference between them, and what negative effects they have? Would be useful to throw in the face of those who claim it's basically harmless to take. Now, this is kind of tangential to that. We are thinking about, and I actually need to prepare a document for it, going through the trans studies mm-hmm. that loads of people online tend to throw at you, and they're like, actually, the science is on our side, and just debunking them.
Because my specialization in psychology, I did an MRes, which means it's a master's in research, which is research methodology. And therefore, reading through papers, I'll be able to spot all of the methodological flaws that these papers have no doubt relied upon concealing.
Some of them are very obvious, even to a layman like myself.
Yeah. More often than not, you'll get things like the wrong form of statistical analysis used, misrepresentation of statistics, methods that affect the end result opposite to what they are saying in the research paper. Lots of things you can spot where some craftiness is going on. Or one thing that you can do, which is more difficult to spot, is that you can just keep on running the experiment again and again, and as eventually you're going to get the result you like and publish that one.
That's a good point. But on the puberty blockers stuff, would that be answering his question, would that be mm-hmm. something you'd be interested in doing?
I think it's actually a very good idea, and it's not occurred to me to explain it in great detail. I think it'd be better to explain it in a video to someone, because
it might be good to have it in both formats, though.
I think it'd be good to talk to someone about it, because I've been so embroiled in psychology that sometimes I find it difficult to explain myself in a way in which a layman could understand, because when you're talking about the biological elements to psychology, it's very jargony, and I find it very difficult to escape that, and particularly if I'm writing, I would probably end up leaning into that, because I wrote most of my academic work, whereas when I'm talking, I tend to use more colloquial language and explain it in a way that's easier to understand.
Yeah. I mean, I know a lot about this stuff without being as in-depth with all of the actual medical jargon, so it might be good for both of us to do that, and I can mm-hmm. just...
I could always, I mean...
Or you once could do I've a direct video or something.
Once I've done the research for it, I could always do a video on it and then repurpose the research I've done into an article. It wouldn't take too much, because I tend to write in full sentences.
And you've not
sentences
done
anyway.
Like a scripted video in ages.
That's true.
I don't know if you've ever done one, have you?
I've done a few.
Okay.
But it's mainly because I do the contemplations on the website, so it takes a lot of time researching that and to do the
yes.
podcast and other stuff as well.
Josh works very hard for us and we appreciate it. But carrying on here, Casey Darling says, so if an anorexic girl believes she's actually fat, would this children's hospital help her lose weight? We can't affirm... Yeah, this is the question that a lot mm-hmm. of people started asking. Yeah. We can't affirm the delusions of people suffering from mental illness. What times are we living in when we are even having these conversations? The end times, Casey. Sorry to break it to you.
I have been saying this since I found out about transgenderism. It's like, oh, you've got gender dysphoria, okay. And you went through with the operation? It's just like, yeah.
Did anybody give you like psychological help first?
Yeah. When a depressed person commits suicide, we call it a tragedy, rightfully so. And when a gender dysphoric person transitions to their gender, it should be like a slightly less extreme version of the same reaction to that.
Yes, absolutely.
It's someone leaning into their mental illness.
Mm. Christian Anderson says the thing that I was wanting to say the whole time, which was, don't want to get attacked for mutilating children? Don't mutilate children. Simple as. And it's the easy solution, isn't it? But they just don't seem to wrap their heads around it. I think it's because most people are aware that the threats are just that. They're just threats. There's not going to be any follow through with them. And I will leave my sentence there before I say anything bad. Freewill2112 says, these people are happy to vandalize society, vandalize the human body, and even reality itself. Absolutely. And Paul Neubauer, how do we keep kids from parents who want to transition them? That's a question I don't really know the answer to. The only thing I can suggest is that I think that parents actively wanting their kids to transition seem to be in the minority. And most of the people who are supportive of kids transitioning are the types who don't want kids in the first place. So we can only hope that they breed themselves out of existence.
I would argue that people who want to transition their kids, that's child abuse, and they should have...
Yes.
Although I am not in favour of the state intervening in most cases, I think that that's a case where they need to get people in, social workers and the likes, to...
Yeah. I'm not a fan of the state, but I'm a fan of this little thing called justice.
And protecting children is...
One of the prime things of justice. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So We've got 2 minutes left to read some comments about Pakistan. Razak was right. Listen, lads, us American viewers aren't that different. We put our pants on one burger at a time, same as you. Our pants just have a holster on the belt.
I wish mine did.
Anonymi, dogs are haram and a lot of people there are scared of them. So for the guy to save the dog, it's quite nice to see. It's uplifting. And that's exactly why I included it, because when these tragedies are shown, it's nice to show that people's humanity doesn't go out the window, because it's easy to despair. But to know that there are people out there that are actually trying to make things better is reassuring. And we do a lot of blackpilling at the Lotus Eaters. It can't really be avoided. And therefore, it's nice to deliberately go out of our way to not make you as miserable about the state of the world.
I also think it's nice seeing stuff like that, because obviously we go on a lot about the differences in culture and behaviour from here and there, but knowing those differences really highlights the ways in which we are similar, and sometimes that shared humanity.
General Haiping, knowing how poor Pakistan's sewage system is, being submerged in poop might be the worst way to die.
Yeah, I agree. It might be one. It's up there, certainly.
I remember hearing a story of a girl who fell through a toilet in a music festival and was trapped in a massive sea of sewage for a couple of hours, and apparently she had PTSD and had to get therapy for years afterwards.
I don't blame her. I've seen festival toilets.
Just using
man.
A festival toilet normally is enough to give you
PTSD of some form.
Ross Diggle, it looked like the guy rescuing the dog was using the black flag of ISIS as a rope. See, even ISIS can have its uses.
I think they just need to rebrand.
Daniel Culler, save the cat, best part of the show.
Yes, absolutely. And on that on that nice hopeful note at the end there, I think that's all we've got time for. Thank you so much for watching this episode. We'll be back on Monday at 1 o'clock as always, so we'll see you then. Goodbye.